Debate continues in Tallahassee over gun reform after the school shooting massacre in Parkland. Mayor Curry promises to sit down and talk with JEA union employees worried about a possible sale of the utility. And could we see year-round daylight savings time in Florida? Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line right now. Join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, it's a celebration of going meat-free at this weekend's Northeast Florida Veg Fest. Plus, Trading Places star Brett Tudor. Find out how you can meet him at the Jack's Home and Patio Show this weekend. All of that ahead this morning. But first, it's Friday and time to discuss a busy news week as we welcome Dan Scanlon, reporter for the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons of the Jacksonville Business Journal is here.
Good to be here.
Business analyst John Burr.
Hey, Melissa.
And our own reporter, Lindsay Kilbride.
Hello.
Good to see you all. Thanks for being here. Lots to talk about this Friday. Everything from Mayor Curry saying he'll meet with JEA union reps over that proposal to sell the utility to another proposal that actually might become law in the state, year-round daylight savings time in Florida. We're going to talk about it all, but our top story this morning: with only a week left in the legislative session, lawmakers in Tallahassee are continuing to debate changes in the state's gun and school safety laws. During an appearance in Jacksonville Wednesday, Governor Rick Scott talked about his $500 million proposal to make the state's schools safer. Now, the governor says he does not agree that the solution to prevent school shootings is to arm teachers. Scott is against that. Instead, he believes we need more armed police officers in Florida schools. Take a listen.
I support significantly increased law enforcement presence. I do not believe we ought to be arming our teachers.
Jacksonville Sheriff Mike Williams was also at the event. He says he'd also rather see more trained officers in schools than arming teachers, but he also said it was a proposal worth talking about.
Having an armed law enforcement officer or an armed security professional in a school and have their mission being protecting the school. So I don't think that a teacher should have a dual hat in that area. I think you need, a professional there to do that. And there's opportunities to talk about, you know, whether or not you allow teachers to supplement that plan at some level. I'm open to having that discussion, clearly.
In addition to putting police in every school, the governor wants mental health workers at all schools, DCF employees posted inside every police department. He wants more funding going toward adding metal detectors, bulletproof glass, and upgraded locks in schools, and even an anonymous see something, say something hotline and app. Among other things, give us a call. We're already getting your calls as we discuss the governor's proposed $500 million spending plan to improve school safety. Let us know your thoughts at 549-2937. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And, of course, we welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Lindsay Kilbride, you covered the press conference with the governor here in Jacksonville Wednesday. He's departing from President Trump, an ally of his, saying he does not think it's a good idea to give teachers guns. The Duval County School Board, most of them said Wednesday they will not authorize teachers or other staff to be armed in schools, even if the state legislature passes a bill making that possible, which they're looking at doing, by the way.
Yeah, I think that right now, I didn't go to the school board workshop that you're talking about, but I know Denise Amos did. I read her article. I'm friends with her. I trust her reporting.
At the Florida Times Union, right.
Definitely, yeah. And so five of the seven school board members were present, and they all agreed about passing a resolution at the next school board meeting, I believe, just to tell the legislature we don't want this. I don't know if that'll have unanimous support on the school board since all members weren't there. And I know, if resolutions don't have unanimous support when passing the resolution, they don't really have as much weight. But I think it's something, I've seen Becky Couch. She's one of the more vocal school board members, especially on legislative issues. She's been tweeting a lot about this, very against teachers having that role. And I think a lot of them, you know, used to be teachers too, and they're seeing it that way.
It's really striking to see how far apart the teachers are from lawmakers on this issue. John Burr, teachers are adamantly opposed, for the most part, to taking up arms in their classrooms. And we're seeing really the governor, as he eyes a run for the Senate, looking to run and oppose Senator Bill Nelson, who is up for re-election. He's tacking more toward the center on this gun issue.
Yeah, apparently so. And, you know, when you talk about arming teachers in schools and adding that responsibility to what they are already supposed charged with doing, to a lot of teachers, that's just a daunting and ridiculous mandate. I mean, you know, they're not trained to do that. And, you know, that's not just a couple of gun courses. You know, that takes a lot of training and a lot of willingness to do it, which most teachers don't have.
Okay, it's 549-2937 to join us. Tim Gibbons, Dan Scanlon. None of the proposals under consideration during the current legislative session call for a ban on assault weapons, which has been the request from most students and parents and community members who've been speaking in Tallahassee, including the survivors of the school massacre in Parkland. They pointed out that there was an armed officer on site when the shooter in South Florida killed 17 people.
Two kind of related thoughts. One, I think that you're correct in the tacking toward the center thing. It would be interesting to see what the governor's response would have been if this was, you know, not during a time when he was running for a different office. It very possibly might be different. One of the things that I find missing in all of this conversation, whether it's be putting more police officers in schools or arming teachers or doing anything of that sort, is the training required for that. You mentioned the armed officer who was actually at the school. One of the things that has come out about that is, as much as people like to just call him a coward, either he was confused about how the situation was happening, or he hadn't had training, in-depth, regular, rigorous training to do it. He used to cover the military, and that's one of the things they would talk about is that, you know, constant, rigorous, ready training, because running into a guy who's shooting people is not a normal thing. Simply giving somebody a badge is not enough to overcome that necessarily. So if you're not going to invest the money in training either the police officers or the teacher, and God knows where teachers would find the time to hit all of the requirements they need to do to be teachers and also be trained to be, you know, armed guards, I don't see how you get the benefit.
But yet there was a lot of pushback about that deputy not going in. And of course, we've all heard about Atlantic Beach Police Chief Michelle Cook this week tweeting that literally, if you're a police officer and you think for yourself for even 1 second that you'll not be able to run toward the gunfire, quit now. I also interviewed the head of the Sheriff's Association in Florida, who basically said the training used to be that we'd set up a perimeter and try to figure out what's going on. No, now the job is get in there, and no matter how you do it, draw the gunfire of that assailant in the school away from the kids and protect yourself. But again, I'm married to a teacher. I've spoken to teachers. Not one of them want the responsibility of packing a gun. And the other side is, if you're a deputy running into that scene and there's somebody with a gun, how do you know if you're not the school resource officer there, if the person with a gun is a teacher authorized or the assailant?
That's right. Yes. And the Atlantic Beach Police Chief, Michelle Cook, she did get a lot of attention this week when she said, Lindsay, this is what you signed on for. You run toward the danger, not away from it. And so I think that's why this has become such an emotional issue for parents all over the country wherever they stand on the issue of gun reform, they want to have peace of mind knowing that their children are safe at school. And as you have covered the Duval County School Board now for a number of years, you've certainly got an earful about that.
Yep. And another part of Scott's proposal that is interesting is he also has some language in there that people aren't really clear what he means. So although he does clearly say in press conferences he does not agree with arming teachers, he does say his plan would provide sheriff's offices the authority, or sheriff's departments, the authority to train additional school personnel. And when asked on multiple occasions in two different press conferences, he couldn't really point to what that means or who that would be. Just not teachers, apparently.
Yeah, I think where the debate's going on that point is, if there is in a school someone with a military background who knows how to use guns, and is volunteering to be some sort of protective agent, maybe that's something that makes more sense than arming your art history teacher.
Well, the only legitimate proposal so far came from Putnam County Sheriff Gator Deloche this week, who basically announced the other day that he would like to give specially selected and trained Putnam County faculty and staff, make them special deputies with 100 hours of firearm training, proficiency training, 150 hours of special deputy sheriff training. That at least gives that teacher, that staff member, some idea. I don't know if any of you guys have ever done this as a journalist. I've done the shoot, don't shoot simulator, and all of my shoots were good. I wasn't quick enough, and I was dead. I was shot by the assailant in the video training system, and the bottom line is your adrenaline is pumping when you're in even a simulated shooting situation.
Let's go to your calls now. Lots of calls as we discuss Governor Scott's $500 million proposal to make Florida schools safer in the wake of the massacre school shooting in South Florida. The legislative session continues this week, and they're looking at a number of proposals on this. As the Duval County School Board rejects one proposal to arm teachers, what are your thoughts? 549-2937 to join us. Andrew on the South Side. Hi, Andrew. Good morning.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
All right. Thanks.
Good. Good. My thought and suggestion would be, why not use state-certified off-duty corrections officers that are looking for some part-time work?
At every school, you mean, rather than a full-time police officer. Thanks for that. And Rick Scott, Lindsey Kilbride, part of his plan involves putting a full-time law enforcement officer at every school. Now, it's my understanding that there already is a full-time officer at most Duval County schools. What about Andrew's point?
I'm not sure if every school has a full-time officer there at all times. And I know
a resource
Florida,
officer.
Yeah, I know Florida in general doesn't. So I think that's, you know, the bigger Dan
Scanlon.
Well, Duval County has its own police department, which is different from many other counties. It's separate from JSO, although Mike Edwards is a former JSO. He's the chief of them. They do have SROs, to my knowledge, in high schools and in most middle schools. But when I was talking with St. John's County Sheriff earlier this week, he said, we have deputies. Our deputies are trained to assist in the schools. They do not and are not planted in the schools. So, again, the knowledge of the deputy who is not assigned to the school is going to be different than the SRO who has an office there. And when you read reports about guns being found on campus, it's normally the SRO, the school resource officer, who gets the tip from the student and then finds the student with the gun.
So I understand the value of that, of the having the school resource officer there to interact with the students, get the tips. I'm always, and there's more of a question, I guess, in an actual statement, but I'm always left somewhat confused knowing the size of school campuses these days. We talk about having an armed deputy there where, like, cool, you have the one guy who's going to rush toward the gunfire, which is, you know,
hopefully
10 minutes away. Right. If he is 10 minutes away, you know, 5 minutes. Like, it's not the little red schoolhouse where the guy's sitting there. And
the little bit of data that has been collected on these shootings, these mass shootings, when I've interviewed, for example, the lead guy at Trauma One at UF Health in Jacksonville was on this program a couple of weeks ago, as he pointed out, these shootings are typically carried out within 3 to 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That is a tight little window of time.
And that's why the students in Tallahassee are pushing for the assault weapons ban without weighing in on that particularly. The idea that rapid fire, being able to shoot rapidly can do a lot of damage in a small amount of time. The students themselves, and I'm not saying that being involved in a school shooting makes you a policy expert, but as people who've lived through this, you know, they can say, having another armed person here would not have stopped it. It was the speed and rapidity at which he could actually carry out the shooting.
Well, the governor, I believe one of the governor's proposals is to have one SRO per 1,000 students. So if you're looking at a 2,000 or 3,000 student school, which is sprawled across how many acres, that might be a better idea. But again, have you ever tried to get across Sandalwood High School? It's a long cavern to run through.
Let's go to Bill in Mandarin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I support the NRRA efforts, that's National Rifle and Republican Association efforts to strengthen the schools. I don't support the arming. And if there's to be anything, money paid for this, I want it paid for out of special taxes on guns and bullets. I don't want a single buck that come out of general funds that normally go to other things like parks or education in general, those kinds of things. One closing point, if I might. This issue is really boils down to, does a individual's rights paramount to the rights of the public, to the public safety? And the answer, in my belief, is absolutely not. Anybody who believes it depends on the particular subject has just indicated that they have walked into the quicksand set up by the NRA arguments in general. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill. And he gets at the heart of this. For a very long time, the balance of this has fallen more on the side of the individual. Now, though, the nation seems to be having the debate over whether the collective right to public safety outweighs the individual's right to own these types of weapons, and whether or not that collective responsibility for children in particular, the safety of children, whether that is going to win the day or not, I think is an open question. But I think Bill just got to the heart of it. John.
I agree that that's always been a huge battle in this country, individual rights versus the rights of the common good that clash from time to time. And I don't think they clash any more than they do over the right to bear arms. But, you know, this we've talked a lot here about having armed people in schools to ward off attacks. There's more to this. I mean, you know, the legislature is considering some really common sense things like not allowing 18-year-olds to buy semi-automatic rifles.
Right, raising the age to 21.
Raising the age to 21, as it is on handguns. And there are other ways. We can't just, you know, totally focus on this school issue. There's other things that can be done and politically can be done that need to be done.
But yet, here I am reporting this week in the Times Union that last week an Edward Waters College student was arrested because he had an AR-15 style assault rifle in his dorm room, which was discovered by faculty. Now, again, I'm not saying that that student was going to do anything with that weapon, but the idea that that was in a school is scary.
This is always the problem when we wade into this discussion of even the idea of the president suggesting that we get away with do away with due process and just arrest the crazy people who have guns. If you actually believe the Constitution says that you have an unfettered right to firearms, the idea that a college student who's over 21 has an assault rifle, has a semi-automatic rifle is, yeah, that okay. Now, they might have a policy that you can't have it in their dorms, but once you get on the path of saying people should have these guns, there's a certain amount of we get outraged at things that are the natural next step of, yeah, if people can have guns, well, they're going to have them in dorm rooms. They're going to have them in churches. They're going to have them in places where people are.
Harper tweets the show, we have one school social worker providing mental health counseling for roughly every 3,000 students up here in Nassau County. We need funding for more mental health services desperately. And here is an email coming into the show from Ricardo. News reports out of Miami say the Broward County Sheriff's Office told officers to secure the perimeter, mm-hmm. not to enter. Please make sure you say that. Thanks for that. Looks like we have Scott Shine calling into the show. He's a member of the Duval County School Board. Hi, Scott. You're on the air. Good morning. Your thoughts?
Hey, good morning, guys. One thing I just wanted to bring up, you know, we talk a lot about our officers being SROs, but it's very different in Jacksonville. These are police officers. In fact, our police chief, JSO Sheriff Mike Williams, used to work for him. So this is a real different issue between a big city like Jacksonville and a lot of these rural communities like Putnam County, and you hear them doing different things there. And I understand the proposal now that's going through Tallahassee would actually codify something that schools can do now. They can allow someone to become a what we call auxiliary police or special police, and they would work under the direction of law enforcement. I don't know that would be something that would be good for Jacksonville because we have a significant law enforcement presence in our schools, but the rural counties, they're in a different situation with budgets. Personally, the idea that someone would, that we're going to put folks in schools with a concealed weapons permit, not at all adequate. I'm actually an NRA instructor. I teach those classes. Numerous shooting sports certifications. Generally, you actually have no training in law enforcement or dealing with an active shooter situation when you're trained to to get a concealed weapons permit. What's most important about that is we train on behalf of the state. We tell people that you are not a freelance law enforcement officer, and we train people to stay away from or move out of danger or move away from fire. Law enforcement is trained to move into fire. So there's 180 degrees difference between a concealed weapons permit holder and someone in law enforcement.
All right. And so then to be clear, Scott, do you then join with most of your other school board members in opposing the proposal to arm teachers?
Well, it depends on where they go. You know, I initially spoke to Senator Baxley's office about this several months ago and told them that instead of concealed weapons permits, you could move to something that already exists, making them auxiliary police. So I think the movement is towards making these individuals auxiliary police, and that's a very different thing. At that point, they are volunteer law enforcement. They have a law enforcement certificate, background check, psych evaluation. And if they want to do that, and I think what's most important about all of this is whatever Tallahassee does, it's an option for the school districts. They don't mandate. And the idea, initial idea was we're going to cut people loose to walk around in schools with a firearm if they have a concealed weapons permit. 100% against that. It's interesting. I know a fellow in South Florida who is former military, former Marine officer, and he's on a school board, and he was like, even with my training, no, that's not what we want to do is just cut people loose in a school with a firearm. We want to make them safe, but there's two lines that we need to cross. One is if you have a firearm in a school, you know, we have 125,000 students in our school system, 180, 90 days of instruction. That's 20 million interactions. What's the possibility that one of those concealed weapons will get loose and then there's an accident? So you have to look at the risk of an accident versus a criminal event like we saw in Parkland.
All right, that's Duval County School Board member Scott Schein calling, and thanks, Scott, for that.
You know, maybe it's smarter to go along with the toughening or the hardening, as they say, of the school. As Lindsay and I were talking about before the show, it is so easy to get into some schools, even if there is a locked front door. Once you're in there, the campus is open. And Lindsay, you said that there were a bunch of schools that don't even have that.
There's about, I think, 11 or so that they are still working on getting the system to the buzz-in system. Now, they say, though, that there is someone there monitoring the door, that it's not just a free-for-all. I haven't tested all the schools. I don't want to say them all so people know all the ones that aren't secure.
But there's more security getting
a
ticket.
Just, like, sneak around in the schools.
There's more security for me to buy a ticket to one of our major concert venues with the bulletproof glass in the intercom system than you have in many schools that I've gone to in the past few years to do interviews.
So I think, so some of the Scott's proposals include metal detectors,
right.
You know, bulletproof glass, things like that. But in some of the issues in Duval schools, just a couple of them I know have really open campuses where they'd have to fence in the entire school. That's a huge project. You know, the number one complaint from the school board and this is, you know, we don't have the capital dollars to do it. It's a whole huge thing with a bill that passed last year that's making it even more difficult. They're not allowed to tax more than they are right now. They're capped by the state legislature to fulfill that need.
You see teachers saying all of a sudden you have money for this, but you haven't had money for years for basic things like books and pencils and all the stuff we need to teach.
A friend of mine who said when this came out, wait, they're going to pay us more to carry a gun? Can't they just pay us more?
I know, right?
It's called
With some of that, though, too, there's different funding sources like that tax money is for capital improvements only in technology. So they couldn't use that pot of money to pay teachers, but they don't even have enough of it to satisfy all of their maintenance projects like air conditioning now.
All this school hardening and training and arming teachers and whatever, it's a very small slice of the problem. And I just don't want people to forget, you know, there are other reforms on gun laws and mental health and other areas to attack this problem, which have to be pursued. We can't just, put a police officer in every school and say, done, let's move on.
And we do need to move on and discuss some other news of the week. Lots of people still waiting on hold to talk about this very important issue. But we are going to move on now and touch on a few other headlines from the week. The number to join us as we move ahead, 549-2937. Well, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry says he plans to sit down with a variety of unions that represent employees of JEA. Curry's meeting with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and other groups is taking place just as a city council special committee plans to meet to look at the pros and cons of privatizing the publicly owned utility. Now, not surprisingly, the unions are opposed to selling JEA, but also this week, the president of the First Coast Manufacturers Association, a conservative-leaning group, Lake Ray, wrote to the mayor expressing concerns related to the possible sale as well. Let us know your thoughts about the latest push to privatize JEA, 549-2937. Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal. This seems to be a bit of an uphill climb for City Hall to build consensus around this.
If they indeed are trying to build consensus. The entire thing is interesting because there's a clear and obvious financial reason to do this. They look around and they say, we can get more for JEA now than we could at any point in the
right.
past.
Right. They're saying the time is now.
The time is now. Which does nicely sidestep the question of, okay, the time is now if you're going to sell it, but it literally in a classic sense begs the question that you should be selling it. You know, it's pointing to, well, you get the most money for your car now. Yeah, but I like my car. I don't want to sell it. So it will be interesting to see what the outcome of this meeting is. Obviously, a lot of the heat that's been around this has been the political side of the mayor and city council fighting over this. Actually getting those whose jobs would be directly affected into the mix, we'll just add another player to the board.
And if the Manufacturers Council is worried about higher rates for their members, well, guess what? That means all of us are going to be facing higher rates if their scenario is correct, not just the businesses, but every resident
There's a certain amount of, and this always feels, somewhat condescending when we talk about this, but there's the same thing at CSX when they had somebody come in and say they want more efficiency and somebody would buy JEA because they're going to, you know, make it more efficient. Efficiency is basically doing the same amount or more work with fewer people or charging more for what you used to charge less for. That's what business does. And if you're an equity firm or if you're a privately owned utility buying JEA, yeah, you're most likely going to raise rates because you just paid a bunch of money for the thing.
Right.
That's why you'd raise rates.
JEA generates $116 million a year for the city. A sale could net anywhere from $2 billion to the most exuberantly optimistic projections, or $6 billion. I think that's probably on the very high end. So the argument for selling is this is a huge influx of cash into city coffers that we could use for a number of things, including money into the school system and other things, maybe infrastructure improvements and so forth.
There's a convention center that people want. There's pensions.
Pay down pension and on and on. And so let me ask all of you this, a regular contributor to this panel, A.G. Gankarski, who isn't here today, wrote a column the other day floating the idea that this could impact Mayor Curry's political fortunes, even floating the possibility of a credible challenge to his second term, because this is just a political loser for him. Dan Scanlon.
Well, you know, a few billion dollars, pay me now, pay me later. There is a major incentive to getting that money into the city right now. Could pay off a lot of things, make a lot of problems go away. But as I mentioned the last time I was here, the only person that you could gripe about your newly owned JEA bill would be the state and the Public Service Commission. Despite the fact that a recent commission study by JEA said the rates could go down, there's still the specter of, as Tim said, they're going to charge more, they're going to cut staff to be more efficient, to earn more money, to earn more profit, and then your power goes out and suddenly there's nobody down the street to fix your lights because they're centralized out of Lake City or Orlando.
I really don't have an opinion on whether this could make Curry a one-term mayor or not. I think that's interesting speculation. I can't really speak to it. What I can say though is Curry needs to take a if he really wants to do this, he needs to take a playbook from John Delaney.
Mm-hmm.
When John Delaney sold the Better Jacksonville plan, he told everybody, here's what we're going to spend the money on. Here's how much we're going to spend for these buildings and improvements. And, you know, this is my word. This is where the money's going. And until Curry or whoever backs this plan comes up with their laundry list and says, by God, this is how the money will be used. This issue isn't going to get off the dime.
That seems to be the common complaint when you go back to pension reform and the you know, trust us, we're the adults, we'll handle it, and we'll come out from a closed door room and
that
and
ain't
do
gonna
it.
Work.
Right. And but that they could, at least pension reform had been dragging on for so long that even just any light at the end of the tunnel, maybe it was a train coming, voters didn't care, they just wanted it done.
Get it done, right.
Right, but this very much has that this sense of utter lack of transparency. And when the mayor comes out and does I'm not saying we should sell it. All options are open. And clearly there's a push from the administration to have it done. I think voters eventually start going, I don't like that feeling that the administration is not being transparent.
Speaking of transparency and sunshine, if I could just treat you all to a little music on this Friday. Yeah, just a little music. Clear the palate. Yes,
a
little sunshine.
Yeah.
Yes, isn't that nice? Yeah. It all started with a haircut. State Senator Greg Stube said he was getting a haircut when his barber complained about how annoying it was to switch between daylight savings time and standard time, and that his kids had trouble waking up early with the switch. So Stube decided to introduce a bill to put Florida on daylight savings time year-round. Surprisingly, it caught fire and has attracted easy bipartisan support, that rarest of birds in Tallahassee. Now, they have to only get U.S. congressional approval. Mm-hmm. So what do you think, guys? Should we go to year-round daylight savings time?
As the Business Journal, we are in favor of increasing our savings rate. So
okay. Tim Gibbons comes down in the yes column.
Only in Florida.
Dan Scanlon, what say you?
Are we in the only in Florida segment?
I guess we are.
For half the year, Florida would be behind Georgia in one reason, the clocks. I don't know if there's any logic to being off 1 hour, especially for the international travelers who are coming in to major airports here. It would really mess up life to suddenly go from one time zone to another.
Yeah.
And you bring up the fact, this has got to have federal approval. No matter what we say, I can only think of like Indiana. Part of Indiana does not do this. And it's the oddest thing when you go there and you got to reset. It's very strange.
The unimpeachable Kevin Murchard is informing me that it's now only in Arizona and Hawaii.
Okay. Been a long time since I've been to Indiana.
Kevin is never wrong, so I'm going with Kevin.
Okay. So, you know, my reaction is I kind of shake my head and said, there's so much that needs to be done in Florida. Why are we
Why
are we burning one calorie on this issue?
But he's got bipartisan support.
That's
across
right.
the aisle.
He can say he crossed the aisle. Exactly.
He can say that about many bills going through the legislature right now. I don't have a strong stance on this either way. I think whenever it changes, I'm upset about it. But I do understand that it would affect things far beyond my waking up early in the morning.
This is not just an only in Florida thing, though. There actually is. This is something I actually know about. This is weird.
There's
a national push. That actually, the idea that the switching back and forth is actually bad for the economy. There is.
I've read about that.
There's decreased productivity.
Yes.
There are more auto accidents.
Heart attacks.
Yes. So it's a bad thing to be switching back and forth. So pick one and go with it. And Florida can be the leader in this movement.
And people will miss church next Sunday when the clock changes because they did not set their clocks.
Linda is in Atlantic Beach. Linda, what are your opinions about year-round daylight savings time?
Well, I have some huge concerns regarding our children and our business. If we change it, our kids are going to be going to school most of the year in the dark. Now, if you want to put it on standard daylight time, that would be awesome. But on daylight savings time, we're now going to have one more hour different in time zones for all the companies we want to do business with to the east. That's not good business.
That's a good point, Linda. And, you know, I'm sure business owners like you are going to let their legislators hear this. It's going to go.
The email's going crazy.
Yes, ma'am. It goes to the Senate Rules Committee, then the full Senate, then Governor Scott will make the decision. So we'll keep you posted. Now, you asked, are we to the only in Florida portion of the show, John?
Yeah, I did.
Yes.
Now we are.
In fact, we are. Finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material, whether it's daylight savings time or other crazy news and notes from the week. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida does a man set his neighbor's car on fire because he suspected the neighbor stole his lawnmower. Yes, it happened in Edgewater, where 38-year-old Brandon Rivera was so frustrated with his neighbor, he set aflame their 1984 little red Corvette. Yes, Rivera told police he thought the couple was stealing from him, so he opened the driver's seat door, dumped gasoline on the Corvette, and set it ablaze. Man.
Plastic fantastic.
Rivera is charged with burglary and arson, and only in Florida does a woman frustrated with her high water bill pay it with more than 49,000 pennies. Just think, if we privatize JEA, I don't think we'll be able to do this kind of thing anymore. Dana McCool drove up to the Deltona Water Department offices Monday with a very big bag of change to pay her $493 water bill. She called it a peaceful protest in a Facebook Live video, which went viral. It shows her dragging a wheelbarrow filled with bags of pennies as she entered the building. According to McCool, the city had been incorrectly charging her for water she was not using, even after a leak had been fixed months ago. Officials with the city of Deltona say if customers have concerns about high water bills, they just need to work with the city. The city's water department accepted her penny payment and spent nearly 3 hours counting
all debts,
the
public
change.
And private, legal tender.
That's right. Well, that's right. Our business editor knows that. He's Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Pennies with you, Dan. What are you, a Foley artist now?
Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union always has some spare change.
Yes. That's it.
Lindsay Kilbride, our own reporter, and our own business analyst, John Burr, always bringing the legal tender to this program. Thanks for being here, everybody.
We have, yes.
We'll be right back.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
Corazon Cinema and Cafe, a St. Augustine local movie and art house, features independent, classic, and foreign films and a monthly comedy night. Beer, wine, and food served, 11:30 to 10 p.m., Wednesday through Sunday. More at corazoncinemaandcafe.com. Florida State University is a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our state and nation. Gifts for first-time buyers are online at fsu.edu/mytag.
Join us Sunday nights for fresh programming beginning at 9 with On the Beam with me, David Luckin, as we spotlight music from the 30s and 40s.
I'm on the beam. Time's flying by.
Followed by Taste Test with host Damian Lamar presenting Urban Radio After Dark.
There is a place that I'm saving.
On the Beam and Taste Test, Sunday nights at 9, only on 89.9 FM. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Record numbers of food and business vendors are turning out for this weekend's 7th annual Northeast Florida Veg Fest. A festival of all things local, sustainable, and eco-friendly. Julie Watkins created this festival, and she has grown it by leaps and bounds over the years. She joins us now. She's also executive director of The Girls Gone Green and a restaurateur. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you are the owner of the Present Moment Cafe in St. Augustine. Let's plug that.
Took that over.
But let's talk about VegFest. Coming up tomorrow in Riverside Park, next to historic Five Points. It's the seventh annual Bigger and Better Than Ever.
It's amazing. It's crazy how much it's grown within just the last couple of years. And what we're seeing here in Jacksonville, it is definitely going to be, I think, changing the shape and dynamic of these restaurants and businesses are going to be popping up probably over the next couple of years. But we have hit our mark of 100 vendors. 100 vendors going to be crammed into Riverside Park. And the upside is they're all going to be presenting vegan food. Not all of them, but about 20 of them. We'll have vegan food. We have animal rescue groups. We're going to have cooking demos so you guys know what to do with the vegan food. If you're growing your own vegetables, if you have your own garden, you're going to have guidance from people that will have booths there. And then they'll also show you great recipes that you can make out of anything that you are able to grow here in Florida. So it really is a win-win across the board. We ask anyone and everyone who is just looking to dabble in nutrition or trying to, you know, get fit, eat better, learn how to be maybe more productive in the community, have a positive impact. We're going to have it all for you out there.
I'm so proud of you. You know, we used to work together some time ago at First Coast News.
Long time ago.
And look at you. I mean, you have taken this thing and made it such a success. And
oh, thank you.
You are this area's most famous vegan, mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say, and certainly the most beautiful.
Oh, my goodness. I love coming on this show.
And you have really brought this into the mainstream.
Well, and thank you, you know, Melissa, for always being a champion to us helping us out and getting the word out, because that really makes a difference, because sometimes what we try to do in these, you know, little smaller niches, just it's hard to reach the public on that level. So this is a great platform, and that's helped us over the years. But yeah, we're hoping to see at least about 10,000 people this year at the festival. It's going to be live music. You're going to have a scavenger hunt. We're going to keep you entertained 24/7. And that's kind of our goal. So you'll be learning a lot, but it's in a fun way.
And what you've done too is you've made veganism accessible to people who they might not want to live the way you do, Julie, because you really are a committed vegan. But they can at least sample some really tasty food and at least experiment with meatless meals.
And I'll tell you, that's one great thing about owning the restaurant as well, because we have tons of people who aren't vegan, who aren't raw, who aren't gluten-free, but they can come in and they can explore a different kind of palate almost of what veganism has to offer, because it's not just grass and lettuce and carrots. There's a lot more dimension to it. So you're right. Having these types of festivals that can reach that audience and let them sample, taste, feel, touch everything is a win-win, because a lot of them do go ooh and ah. They're like, wow, I can't believe that this doesn't have dairy in it or eggs mm-hmm. or any kind of meat. So it's really the way that we prepare food now has really changed, I would say, over the last 3 years. It's you go in any grocery store and you see tons of choices these days, which are healthier versions of the other stuff that maybe has a little bit more saturated fat, cholesterol.
Right.
So it's getting there.
Yes. The options have gotten so much more appealing and appetizing and more easily available, which is great, and more affordable. So
we need it to be convenient, you know?
Right.
A lot more
convenient
to want to do it.
So come on out tomorrow for the 7th annual Northeast Florida Veg Fest, taking over Riverside Park next to historic Five Points in Riverside. The fun begins at 11 a.m. Thanks to one of my favorite people, Julie Watkins. 10,000 people are expected to turn out.
And we still have VIP tickets available, too. So that's a different kind of experience.
Mm. Okay. And the website is?
nfvegfest.org.
Okay. nfvegfest.org. And it should be a beautiful weekend weather-wise. So get out and enjoy yourself. And Julie will be there, of course. You'll get to meet her. It's going to be a great Saturday. Julie, always great to see you.
You too.
And have fun.
Thank you.
In a moment, a look ahead to the Jack's Home and Patio Show and Trading Spaces star Brett Tudor. That's next.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Highway, hospital, home, work, where negligence causes injury or death makes a difference in the law that applies and in the result. More at waynehogan.law.
Corazon Cinema and Cafe, a St. Augustine local movie and art house, features independent, classic, and foreign films and a monthly comedy night. Beer, wine, and food served, 11:30 to 10 p.m., Wednesday through Sunday. More at CorazonCinemaAndCafe.com. Florida State University license plates support scholarships for students at FSU, a preeminent institution that enriches and contributes to the state and nation. Gifts for first-time buyers can be found online at fsu.edu/mytag.
The film Phantom Thread is nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. On the next Fresh Air, Paul Thomas Anderson talks about directing and writing the film. And we listen to our interview with Cynthia Heimel, who died Sunday. She gave humorous advice about sex and relationships in her Village Voice and Playboy columns and in books like Sex Tips for Girls. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
President Putin says Russia now has an invincible nuclear missile. China paves the way for the president of the People's Republic to be all-powerful, and the UN ceasefire in Syria proves nearly useless as the bombing of eastern Ghouta continues. The global edition of the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Keep up to date with your favorite WJCT programs or listen to your favorite 89.9 FM shows online. Visit WJCT.org and explore a variety of programming content. It's just a click away. WJCT. Log on, find out.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the hit TLC home improvement show Trading Spaces returns to TV in April after 10 years off the air. That is so exciting for devoted fans of the show. And in particular, they're going to get to know a hot new face, dreamy carpenter Brett Tudor. Yes, I'm sorry, Brett, that's how they describe you. Now, Tudor is not only handy with a hammer, he's also a surfer, a mixed martial artist, even a musician. You can meet this talented guy at the Jacksonville Home and Patio Show today through Sunday at the Prime Osborne. We've got a preview for you right now as Brett Tudor joins us live here in Studio 5. Hey, Brett, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you. This is so exciting because Trading Spaces was just beloved by fans. Yeah. It's been off the air for 10 years. It's coming back. What a great gig for you to land this show.
I didn't realize until we started filming how lucky I was, because I had the interview, had a meeting with it. I didn't watch the show a lot when I was young, mm-hmm. and so I just didn't really remember it. I remembered like Ty and things like that,
right.
but I didn't watch it that much. And so we start filming it, and you start to realize, I was like, oh my, this show is gonna be awesome.
Yeah.
We had so many fun things happen, crazy things. It's mayhem. And then I started to learn not only how many people love the show, but why. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so lucky. It's like being adopted into a highly dysfunctional family, but a very loving one.
Oh, people can't get enough of this stuff. Now, you're going to be taking the stage at the Home and Patio Show, talking to a live audience about the same kinds of things you'll be doing when Trading Spaces goes back on the air in April. DIY projects homeowners can do to improve their space and things like that,
yeah.
right? What are some easy projects that you're going to be talking about?
I'm going to be talking about a lot of stuff. I'm going to be talking a little bit about my experience. I have a kind of a combination of things that I've done, from carpentry to making tables. I have a nonprofit where we've built septic systems and rainwater systems in third world countries with the Peace Corps. I've used to frame. I've done a lot of renovations. I'm an energy auditor as well. So we're going to be talking about kind of the whole home. And so what I'm kind
of... I've heard you could run the Federal Reserve as well.
Golly,
is that true?
Of all things, I'm the last person you want doing that.
Your resume is so impressive. It's like, what else can you do? No.
Well, we're talking about not just carpentry, but the entire home. And I'm really excited to just answer questions that people have about any part of their house.
So what are you most commonly asked by homeowners that want to do some of this on their own? What's the big question you most commonly get?
Probably they see things on TV, and sometimes it can misrepresent just how much it costs, how long it takes.
You guys make it look easy.
Right. Well, a lot of these shows have a lot of people off camera that are doing all this work. Uh-huh. Trading Spaces is not that. We got $2,000. We got 2 days. And if it doesn't get done, they don't care, because it makes for good TV. That's our show. It's authentic. But a lot of times you see these people with these huge budgets, tons of people, and then people try to replicate that. And so I think a lot of questions I get are once people have started projects and they're like, hey, what are we doing wrong? Why is it so expensive? Why is this taking so long? And that's the reality. It's a lot of work, and materials are a lot more expensive than people may realize.
So be careful before you spend, before you take on a big project.
Just be smart. Do really, 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 90% of it is prep. And just knowing exactly what materials you want, you know, and anticipating surprises. You start moving walls and open up drywalls, there's going to be surprises behind it. And having that little 10 to 20% extra budget for those things that not if, but will probably not go to plan.
Measure twice, cut once.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
Big in your business, isn't it?
It is very big. And that's kind of a good rule of thumb for
a lot of things.
Yeah.
Now, before you got this show, you were going through a tough time as someone who does a lot of things, but also you were trying to land acting and TV jobs, right?
Yeah, well, I was doing stunt work. Yeah, I wasn't acting. I was doing stunt work. And I have a home inspection and business in Austin. And it wasn't a horrible, horrible time in life, but it was just one of those chapters where, you know, it wasn't all rainbows and butterflies. Had a whole lot of things going on. My mom was sick with stage 4 colon cancer. And just, you know, when it rains, it pours sometimes. I know a lot of people go through times like that. And I started traveling, and that seemed to do the trick. Yeah.
And then you came back from a trip, and the next thing you know, you got cast on Trading Spaces.
And
how about it?
Here we are. It's been crazy.
Wow. Well, what a ride for you. It's exciting to meet you, and it's exciting to have you come to town. You're going to be appearing later today at Home and Patio Show today through Sunday, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so people just need to head on over to the Prime Osborne Convention Center, and they can check out Brett Tudor, star of the reboot of Trading Spaces, the much-loved TLC show, which will debut on April 7th. But you can meet Brett this weekend. And so thanks so much for being here. Have fun while you're in town. We appreciate you coming by.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs our board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you missed any portion of the show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. And 1A's Friday News Roundup is coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend. And make sure to catch our new statewide program, The Florida Roundup, looking at the biggest stories of the week from all over the state. That's today at 1. We'll be back then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.